I'm going to shift gears a little bit here, and we're going to go from the United States to overseas, and we're going to talk a little bit about limb loss survivors in five different countries. We're looking at Bosnia, El Salvador, Ethiopia, Jordan, and Vietnam, and we're going to be looking at a population that's mainly landmine survivors, but in the interest of equity, we also served survivors who were survivors of cancer, amputations, as well as diabetes and other illnesses and accidents. I want to start out by saying I have no relationships to disclose at this time. And when we're talking about persons with disabilities in general, we know that there are a lot of barriers and obstacles that are faced here in the United States among the disability community. But when we start to shift into international settings, particularly in post-conflict situations, you're going to see that these problems, barriers, and obstacles begin to be exacerbated. So I'm going to talk a little bit about those, some of the conceptual framework behind Survivor Corps or Landmines Survivors Network, as it was formerly known as, their conceptual framework behind their programs, a little bit about our monitoring and evaluation system, and the results that we had from a year and a half of implementation. So when we're looking at survivors, this is a survivor of ours who is in Vietnam, and as you can see, he has a double leg amputation. And one of the big issues for our survivors are economic opportunities, because they're usually operating in post-conflict countries where economic opportunities for the general population are generally low. So when you begin to add on to that the problems and barriers that a person with a disability faces, in addition to somebody who gets a disability very quickly as a result of a landmine incident, you begin to see that problems, barriers, and obstacles escalate very quickly. So you have physical disabilities, often psychological trauma, a lot of psychosocial opposition from family members, from friends, from the neighborhood and the community. It may be very difficult for them to access assistive devices and health services. And as I said, economic systems are generally disrupted usually in these countries. So let's look at the conceptual framework that we look at this in. LSN and Survivor Corps feels very strongly about the intersection between health, social empowerment, and economic opportunity. When they looked at the programs, they felt like you couldn't take any one of these apart and look at it all by itself, that really they intersect with each other and exacerbate on each other, but the survivor is the center, and that's the big key in their conceptual framework, is that the survivor is the very center of the program, is the center of everything, and if you're not thinking about the survivor, and you're not going at this with a human rights-based approach, you're going to focus on the health, you're going to focus on the social empowerment, you're going to focus on the economic opportunity, and forget the actual person at the center. So when they looked at their programs, they're focusing on how do we enable survivor recovery. So we look at improved health-related quality of life, social empowerment, and improved economic opportunities. I'm going to take this framework and sort of flesh it out a bit and look at what specifically we did to address barriers that survivors faced. For example, if we're looking at improved health-related quality of life, we can look at both mental health and physical health because they go hand in hand in tandem. On the physical health side, you can look at needing to get involved in sports, looking at medical equipment, medications, healthcare, assistive devices, but on the other hand, also looking at psychosocial support and providing education so that they can care for their wounds, for their injuries, for their paralysis, for whatever they're dealing with. This is a little complex slide here, but we're looking at, in green here, specific interventions where we gave money for. So we would give money for survivors to be able to get medication or medical device or transportation or rehabilitation services or emergency medical treatment. The black are something we call links and referrals. Links are where we take a peer support outreach worker and they actually take a survivor to the services that they need. Whereas a referral, they give a referral to the survivor and say, you can go here and get this service. So you can see that a referral requires a little bit more empowerment than a link, but there are obviously survivors in the very beginning who need to have that extra nudge of having somebody actually take them to the service. So on the mental health side, we look at survivor groups. We're very key about bringing survivors together so that they know that they're not the only one out there with a disability, that there are other people who have similar situations, and that they can rise above the situation that they're in. We also pay for services to get to psychologists, psychiatrists, sports groups. I'm going to click through. So then if we look at social empowerment, I think all of us use that term a lot. How do we define that? Specifically at LSN Survivor Corps, we're looking at improved knowledge of how to advocate. In a lot of these places, people don't know how to do that. Improved knowledge of what their rights are as a person with a disability. Not only what their rights are in the law, but how they can advocate for that. And improved participation in community, in our terms here, are actually talking about accessing information for themselves and making decisions for themselves, that they're not relying on family and friends to do that for them. So as you can see, we're addressing these through human rights education, athletic recreation participation, social culture participation, and human rights education. And I'm just going to blaze through this. I'm only going to look at economic opportunity very quickly because we're not going to talk about it much in this session. But we do look at helping them open a small business, increase their income, hold a job, or become employed. So if you put all of this together, this is everything all together and is a very busy slide. But I talked about pretty much all the main pieces of that beforehand. So what are our programs? What is peer support? So in LSN Survivor Corps' definition of peer support, it's someone who's already gone through having a disability, having a kind of injury, and has recovered from that and has had training in how to provide psychosocial support as well as services for health, economic opportunity, and social empowerment. So here we have one of our peer support workers along with one of our survivors there in the wheelchair in Vietnam. Again, empowerment underlies everything. As part of that, when we were developing our monitoring and evaluation system, what we consider to be the key piece of it is the IRAP, the Individual Recovery Action Plan. At the very beginning of the program, every survivor sits down with their peer support worker and they set objectives for his or her recovery. This means that they have to prove increased responsibility over time. It's based on the three-sector approach of health, economic opportunity, or social empowerment, so they have to set objectives in one of those or all three of those areas, and it becomes the center point of their program. Their peer support worker follows up with them in every visit to see how far they've progressed. They also assign responsibilities, so the peer support worker does some, and the actual survivor does some. Outreach workers are trained peers who are also trained to empower the survivor. They're not going to do everything for the survivor. They're trained not to do that. But they also do a lot of education. Education in rights, education in advocacy, education in how to care for their wound, education in where to go when they need certain services. So basic components are psychosocial support, home and hospital-based visits, as well as support groups. We do links and referrals. We also give small direct assistance grants for either health, economic opportunity, or social empowerment. And we also do education and learning materials. So our M&E system. We implemented a new M&E system in 2008, which involved 13 forms that were very long and very complicated. But the main part of it was that we did a beginning incoming form where we could assess whether the survivor needed the services or was eligible for the services that we provided. And then after that, we gave them what we call an initial interview. An initial interview sort of looked at health, economic opportunity, social empowerment, to go along with our theme, and looked at outcome indicators. We then reapplied that form in our interim interview, which is the same questions asked again, so we could look at, have they improved over a year of services? And then after another year at the end, all survivors are required to graduate by 2 years or they're kicked out. So we learned that we just have so many survivors that we have to serve that we only have limited resources to serve them. So survivors are told that they have to leave within 2 years. We used paper-based forms that were entered into a computerized database. There were standardized reports available to all levels in the organization. It was outcomes-based, and it was founded on assessing from all levels of the organization what each person needed, whether it was an outreach worker or the social worker who supervised them or the administrator of the country office or the main office or donors. So what's this about? I'm looking at two groups. I took the data that we had from 2008 until October of 2009, at which point the monitoring and evaluation system was closed because the main headquarters office lost funding. I looked at our initial and interim group and our initial and exit group. And the reason I did that was it was about the same time period. And also, when we implemented the system, we implemented it across the board. So everybody who was in the peer support program at the time got an initial interview, but it wasn't necessarily a first, not everybody was a real true new survivor. So some of the initial exit group that we look at here are actually survivors who have been in the program for 6 or more months. Our main outcome measure for health was the SF36, which is a validated tool that's used in many different countries that looks at 8 domains in health, both mental health and physical health, and also 2 summary scores. It's self-perceived health-related quality of life, so the survivors could see how it changes over time. And in social empowerment, we're looking at knowledge of how to advocate, knowledge of rights, and participation in community. So a quick, brief overview of our group. We had about 470 survivors in the group who had 2 points that I could look at. So we had mostly survivors in the age group above 40 years old. And as you can see, 3/4 of the survivors are male and only 1/4 are female. That's because in foreign countries, a lot of times the males are the ones who are more active and who are more likely to experience a landmine. 256 of our survivors had a landmine incident, 91 diabetes, and a smattering of other different causes. Again, we're looking at Bosnia, El Salvador, Ethiopia. Now, I have to explain the Iraq group. These are Iraqi survivors who are in Jordan, and for the purposes of donors, we actually separated them in a separate group. I also looked at limb amputations. How many limb amputations are we looking at? Most of our survivors don't have any limb amputations. Why am I looking at these survivors if they don't have limb amputations? A lot of them have injuries or paralysis in various areas of their body, and we consider them to be survivors as well. You can also see that we do have a significant amount of survivors who have more than one amputation. If we look at the survivors, you think only 470 survivors, but really, if I look at the whole group of survivors, 1,532, and look at the households, because we also support the households and the family, we're actually looking at a total of 6,738 total household members in our group. And as you can see, that survivors only account for about 1/4 of that. So what are our results? We looked at SF36. So from the left, we have physical functioning, role physical, bodily pain, general health, vitality, social functioning, role emotional, and mental health. And this is where they came in at. And you can see that we're hovering around 40, and except for vitality, which is up in 50. And why I point out 50 is that for the SF36, the generalized U.S. population is, the average is 50 on the SF36. So as we expected, our survivors are coming in well below what we would expect to be the average score. When we look at interim, though, we see a significant change in all domains. We see that these things drastically increase within a year. Here I'm just looking at the change. I didn't do the thing. And so we were expecting with this new monitoring evaluation to be able to see 2-point change. And you can see that we far exceeded a 2-point change when we looked at the mean change in SF36. This is at the exit group. So I'm going to look just at the summary scores, physical health and mental health. Again, we saw big increases in both and an exit. And I had a hypothesis. So if you came in at a low physical health score, were you more likely to show bigger change? So here we have the initial health score over here. And if it was really high, not much change was shown, or no change, or little change at all. But if they came in at a very low score, you can see that they had much more change over time. Again, the same for mental health. So how do we say that we were really effective if we don't have a comparison group? So I looked at, what about if we look at the group and say, how much time has it been since they've had their amputation or injury? And when I looked at the group and saw the age group from the time period 0 to 2 years, and we saw that the main initial physical health score was 33.57, and if they were greater than 2 years, it's 43.18, which shows that even without any intervention, survivors do have an increased or a better physical health and mental health score. So, and it's a significant difference. But if we continue on and look at the change in score when looking at those same two groups, we can see that the 0 to 2 years still have a bigger change than the group that has had longer since their amputation, but that even with the group that has been had a significant time since their amputation or injury, peer support still demonstrates change in both their physical health and mental health. So my conclusion from that is, even though we aren't looking at a comparison group, we can say that peer support is helpful for both new survivors as well as survivors who have had their injury for a period of time. And actually, the average time since amputation in the group that was greater than 2 was actually 15 years out from their amputation. I looked at number of body areas and that were affected, and I know that there were some sessions earlier about how do you describe disability when you have disability in many different areas and many different, many different levels of disability, and how do you describe them. It was very difficult. I have very detailed information about disability here, including left and right, and was it a below-the-knee amputation, was it above the knee amputation, but trying to come up with a summary score when summarizing paralysis and injury and amputation and hearing loss and vision loss was very complicated for me, so this was the best way I could come up with to look at that. Did not see much of a change when looking at the number of body areas that were affected, but it was very interesting to look at when they entered into the program. We asked them if they used assistive devices currently, and we saw that if they do currently use assistive devices, they actually had a lower health score than if they did not. So I'm assuming that that means that people who don't use assistive devices are not able to get around as much. I am going to skip ahead and look at social empowerment. Those are soccer players in El Salvador who are playing soccer, obviously. So when we looked at social empowerment and looked at initial versus interim scores, we saw that survivors came in, 25% of them knew how to access information or were making decisions for themselves. By interim, we increased that percentage to 53% of them were able to access information and make decisions. And those who came in with knowledge of how to advocate came in at 19%, and at interim had 67% of them knew how to advocate, and from 21% to 67% for describing disability and local laws and policies, which is a huge change in this group. So then I said, well, what about if their experience accessing information and making decisions, does that affect their initial SF-36 score? And I found that there was a change, but it wasn't a statistically significant change. And again, the same for advocacy as well as knowledge of rights. So my conclusion is that peer support is effective in improving social empowerment as well as their survivors' self-perceived quality of life, and that peer support is an intervention to consider, particularly in conflict situations where we don't have the resources to have lots of mental health personnel to affect the psychosocial outcomes in survivors with limb loss, landmine survivors, and diabetes, et cetera. further resources, please check out survivorcorps.org. Although the main organization closed its doors a couple months ago, some of the network offices in Vietnam, Bosnia, and El Salvador have spun off into independent organizations, and they still provide peer support to limb loss survivors internationally. Thank you very much.
Beautiful pictures as well.
We're going to open the floor to questions now. I don't know if there's, yes, there's a roaming mic.
Steve Kay from the University of California, San Francisco. I wanted to make, actually, this isn't a big question, more of a comment on this, that the SF-36 is biased according to whether the person has a mobility impairment. So that, and somebody who is not in the room, really isn't here, has actually done a study and will be talking about it, I think, Wednesday. But it's an interesting analysis, and I suspect that that may be why you find that the people who are using mobility devices are actually seem to be less healthy, because it's not really, it's measuring health in a sort of, in a way that penalizes somebody if they have a disability, basically. So, other questions?
Interestingly enough, when we originally applied the SF-36, we tested it out among our social workers and our outreach workers, and actually the outreach workers scored higher than the social workers on all the domains. And all of our outreach workers are persons with disabilities. We think that part of it might be that they feel that they are more empowered and have better control over their health because they're actively helping other people with their health.
This question is regarding the study about substance abuse and mental health, and I wanted to know if the study participants identified whether or not they were neglected by the mother versus the father, or both, and if so, if there was any correlation or association with that neglect with that particular parent and their substance abuse use, or substance use.
That's actually a great question. And one of the problems with using the CTQ, the Childhood Trauma Questionnaire, is it doesn't allow you to make those distinctions. It just showed that the person scored above the criterion cutoff. And so it's a wonderful area of examination, obviously, isn't it? And when we did the original study with the over 800 subjects, we have all that data. And when we analyzed that, we didn't see a big difference between the two. But I didn't really like the way we collected the data there, and I'm not sure how good that data is, actually.
Are you anticipating further studies in that area?
Yeah, for sure we are. Yeah, we're still going. We still have some grant money, so for sure. Thank you.
And I have another question regarding TBI and mental health. And I wanted to know if TBI was measured at various levels and at various levels of severity when they compared to those with mental illnesses, and also was the type of severity of mental illness accounted for in comparison with the TBI patients?
No, the severity of TBI was not measured at all. Oh, sorry. It was simply a checkbox, yes, no, has the individual experienced TBI. It did not even have to be corroborated through medical evidence. It just had to be the clinician was aware that the client was reporting a TBI or was aware that they did have a TBI. In terms of mental health severity, we did control for diagnosis, but not necessarily did we control for the severity of symptoms at time of admission.
I have a question Dr. Slater, about suicide. Was I correct? Correct me if I'm wrong. It seemed to me that the young adults with disabilities had higher rates of planning and ideation about suicide, but lower rates of attempts, was that correct? And did you want to, and there seemed to be an age relationship, so did you have any data that might help us understand why those young adults seem to be very serious in their suicide thoughts, but not actually as likely to make the attempts?
Well, to be honest, the first thing that came to mind was equal opportunity access to methods of suicide.
I see.
But this was a preliminary analysis. There are limited variables in this data set for looking at the specific situations around a suicide and follow-up attempt.
Okay. I don't see anyone else with a yes, I do. Okay.
Dr. Fox, I have a question about the last line in your presentation. You indicated that the curriculum and consultation, what that would include. I'm assuming then that you're going to be able to gauge the or follow up after you've trained the personnel to see what the results are in terms of the outcome, the health outcome for participants that they're working with. And a follow up question to that is then how do you fold in or link in the community based service boards or providers in the community who are actually working with people once they are in community settings?
Great questions. I'm going to answer just because I was the one that looked at the grant. I don't think that there is an evaluation planned on the training. I'm not from the state, so I can't say for sure, but I don't think we're doing the kind of evaluation that we should do. I think it would be a really important piece of information if we're going to put a lot of money into this. And I'll tell you what, I will talk with the state, and if you give me your name, I can talk to you about it, give you more information. The second question, just lost it.
It's related to how your mental health consumers, one of the things I was surprised about is that you have no mental health consumers that are part of this development process, as far as I can tell. And there's no survivors, and it doesn't appear that your community-based providers are involved in this process of development.
Well, actually, you just didn't show some of that, because in fact, a prior HRSA grant did develop what we call circles around the state. And we have like 8 of these circles that include both providers of services and persons that have TBI. And they have been part of this discussion, not maybe systematic, it's not like we've done a needs assessment, but they have been talking with the advisory board and saying, we need mental health services, we're not getting access to mental health services. So it's both actually consumers and providers of other services, not necessarily mental health providers, but people who work in housing, or people that work in centers of some sort, whatever they might be, some sort of rehabilitation centers. So they have had input, and I think they were actually quite influential in getting the state to then say, we really need to do some systematic training to really make sure that our mental health system understands the TBI population and recognize that there are many, many parallels here, and it's not like I'm a mental health professional, I really don't understand that. It was only in that one overall functioning category, it wasn't a mental health category, where there wasn't some improvement.
I know this is probably a little unorthodox, but the presentation on peer support and the presentation on suicide sort of led me to ask the question, of whether or not there are peer support teams that are trained to assist those young children who are being abused because of their lifestyle choices. And if so, can you help us identify what some of those organizations are with those two peer support teams?
When I looked at the National Registry of Best Practices for suicide screening, assessment, and different intervention approaches, nothing has been designed specifically for any of the disability communities that I could find so far. I'm sure there's something out there. I know that Washington State has made some efforts. There's a wonderful report that's come out from 2009 data. But is this a question also for you?
Again, in Ohio, thank you. I'm hanging off the chair here. In Ohio, there's not a lot of money for developing those kinds of programs. We try to do it at the community level, but as far as I know, in the area, the Dayton area, the Cincinnati area, where I do my work, there's not a lot in place for those children, and it's a good question, or for the women, yes.
Monitored not only TBI but also suicidality as well as PTSD symptoms. They use peer support workers who are not trained physicians, so they can't diagnose TBI or diagnose PTSD or suicidality, but they are monitoring for it over time to be able to refer them to the appropriate providers.
Just one more thought to add to this. I think given the taboo that suicide has in our society, the providers, we need to look at our own issues and our own comfort level around discussing this in order to encourage awareness and consideration in the peer groups.
Okay, well, thank you very much, and I'm sure the panelists would be willing to answer individual questions.